Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 384 of the Roguecast, recorded September 6th, 2022. Roll the llama.
All right, we are back, all three of us. Nick is back from the world wilds of COVID.
Yes.
How are you feeling?
They were not fun wilds. No, we all three have done it.
Yep.
None of us, I think, would recommend it necessarily. Dave, did you like COVID? Are you a fan?
Here's the thing. The first half, I was like, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But then once I was out for a week or two, I was like, dropping it to 2.5 stars.
Honestly, I think the worst is the isolation.
It is. And being able to do anything.
Yeah, I had to isolate from my wife for like 2 weeks, or like a week and a half. And that sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. My buddy, my fellow podcaster with a Star Trek podcast, Text Trek, father, he has it right now, and he's having to isolate from his partner, and yeah, it's just...
You guys should try what I did. Give it to your wife and your kid.
I don't know how I didn't give it to my wife.
I don't either, because I caught it the day after I realized I had it, and I had slept in the same bed with my wife.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, she's going to get it.
Yep.
And then we had a day where I thought maybe she'd avoid it, and I was like, okay, I'll sleep in the office for a week. And then the next day she had it, and I'm like, well, I guess we all have it in this house.
Yep.
My son, honestly... was pretty asymptomatic, and he just watched YouTube all day, so it was basically the same as every other day.
I mean, I watched a lot of things.
How many movies did you watch, Nick?
I think it was 30, maybe?
All right, and on average week, you usually only watch like 20. So
I have not been watching as many movies lately, so I was catching... No, I mean...
That's low, huh?
That was... it has been low. But, yes. I'm back to my movie-watching days.
Nick, were you able to enjoy that stuff to some degree?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was never, like, completely out of it that I just
Because you understand
like,
that Star Wars display isn't going to build itself.
Oh, I'm very well aware. I wish I had, like, brought home some of that stuff so I would have, like, messed with it.
Many people came in, and I was like, pretty cool looking, right? It's on hiatus right now.
And they're like, no, never.
But no, it's good to have you back, glad you, and you're feeling better.
Yes.
And all.
Yep.
That's good.
All right.
And we're able to do the podcast again.
We are, yeah.
Skip weeks.
And that's
there.
The most important thing.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Anyway, it's good that you're doing good.
Yeah, no, let's do the podcast.
All right. Store news. There was quite a few things last year, couple weeks. Nemesis Lockdown, which is that sort of Aliens, the board game thing.
Yeah, it's like Xenomorph style, but not licensed.
Super high production value, got like super miniature.
Yeah, there's there's like a trainer mechanic in it. Like one of you might turn out to be the alien or something.
And what's the deal? Do we have the main game back in after having been out for a while?
The main game is back in. We also got Lockdown, which is a standalone game that is also an expansion that is like in a space prison or something.
I need to do some investigation on this trainer mechanic, because if you turn and your guy is an alien, don't you just assume he's the bad guy? I'm not bad.
I think it's more like the embryo explodes out of you or something.
That makes more sense.
I'm figuring just, like, launching, like, a human cannonball out. I was killed by the launch of the facehugger.
My sternum was destroyed.
And then we got Wormholes, which is the new game from AEG.
Okay.
We got Marvel Dice Throne, which is a game that I've been playing and I really, really dig.
Dice Throne's been a popular game forever, and they had done... have they done Disney Dice Throne or
no,
any
Marvel
other license?
No, Marvel Dice Throne the first one.
Oh, very cool. It's interesting to see the licensed stuff hitting various game franchises, so that, like, the Exit franchise got Lord of the Rings,
yep.
Escape game got Star Wars.
Unlock, yep.
And Marvel's hit several of them.
There's also Villainous that has Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars.
Yep. And unlike times of yore, these licenses are not a sign of bad game.
True.
Like, that used to be just a thing. In fact, you can almost be sure it's not, because they are attached to already successful franchises that they build their own,
Is there a specific loadout with Marvel Dice Throne?
So there's a four-player box set that we've got right now that has Thor, Loki, Scarlet Witch, and Miles Morales.
Oh, that's cool. That's
and then there's,
loadout. I like that.
There's two more two-player ones that we have on the way I can't remember how the matchups are, but Black Panther, Doctor Strange... Captain Marvel, and somebody I'm forgetting.
I would say Miles sounds a little outclassed there.
No, Miles kicks butt.
Really?
Miles has a ability where if you get you charge up one of his abilities, he gets a second punch.
Ooh.
So he basically gets like a second turn. So I wailed on the Scarlet Witch in one of my games. And then she exploded me with Chaos Magic.
I'll say this. Miles, although he doesn't usually quite, is usually not considered to have the experience that Peter does. Peter Parker, Spider-Man, is a guy who can take on just about anybody, potentially. And part of it is that Spider-Sense thing. He's always keeping a step ahead, and then makes you mad by telling you mean jokes about yourself, and then he punches you.
Miles has in the 80s, he punched out Fire-Lord.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if I buy it, but it is a thing that somebody wrote.
Yeah, so Miles, does he have, like, the Venom Blast or something akin to it? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's really fun.
Cool.
They did a really good job sort of adding the characters into the dice throwing mechanic. Speaking of dice, we got a big stock of old school dice back in. So we got the dice bags of holding.
Mm-hmm.
We got the fancy roll up scroll looking dice trays.
We got some gnome dice forged
gnome
dice.
Forged dice and orc forged dice, which are like the orc ones are like stone.
Yeah, the orc ones are cool.
And the gnome ones have like gears and stuff.
Yeah. Whenever we get those dice in, it's kind of like when we get a reorder of the miniatures from WizKids in.
Yep.
Like, I want to pause while we're pricing them and putting them all out, even though there seem to be an endless number.
Yes.
Because they look so cool. They are super cool-looking dice. So, yeah, come take a look. Everybody knows we have a pretty good dice stock, but it is at a peak right now.
Well, and we also got an order of Foambrain, which had some new dice in there as Yeah, there's some cool
options aplenty. I know. I've made signs.
Animal encased dice.
Yes.
And there's like a pink Triceratops now.
Yeah, we got some of the Dino dice back in.
Yeah. They're cool.
They're encased animals, right? Not animal encased in dice.
Said was probably wrong. I mean,
little plastic animals. They're not dice in animals. Yes.
I want a llama with a giant D20 inside it that's killing it.
Yeah,
no. So do you roll the llama?
Yes.
You have to actually gut it and remove the dice from it, and then you just roll it like a normal dice.
What if you roll and then it spits at you? Is that like a critical fail?
That's a crit, yeah. We got the newest Kobold Press book, the Book of Ebb and Tides, which
Kobold,
is their sort of...
Yeah, Kobold Press, which is a third party, which does production values as high as anything you get from Dungeons & Dragons or Pathfinder. We now have like a whole shelf for them back because they look so cool together. And that, what's the other shelf that we've kind of given over?
There's the one, I don't remember the name of the company is, but it's the one that had the like guide to alchemy and remarkable
shops. They're like, you know, guides to NPCs and shops and stuff like that. Like really good detailed backgrounds.
Are they the ones who do the Dungeons and Doggies and stuff?
No, different guys.
Yeah. Okay. It's just in that same section. But if you're looking for some D&D stuff that's just more cool options or you know new places to adventure, new monsters to use, there is a good section for you back there with a couple features in it.
And the Ebb and Tides has shadow stuff, so it's like the Shadow Realm and some characters and that kind of thing. So we got the Pathfinder Lost Omens Travel Guide, which is I'm sure like different geographical regions in Pathfinder's world.
Mm-hmm.
We got a board game called Plunder, A Pirate's Life, which is looks like a fun pirate game.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got a huge restock of indie press games, including a whole bunch of new ones.
Yeah, now we've made, and these are role-playing games, just to make it clear. People who've shopped here for any length of time probably know we have a nice display near the back of the store of indie games. It's like got like dozens of choices, mm-hmm. not just like... You know, if you don't feel like playing D&D, you have options, mm-hmm. man. And it's not just the other big systems. We got a ton of indie game options. A lot of these are, you know, really cool high concept games you might play in one night. And lately we're beefing up single player games.
Yeah, we got a bunch of those.
Like four or so now.
Dwelling, Broken Cask, Whisper in the Walls, and Lighthouse at the End of the World.
Yeah, and the way that we've sort of described them is kind of a combination of like sort of choose your own adventure elements. Some kind of creative writing / journaling things. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll answer questions and prompts that move your story forward and describe your character and things like that. They're really cool. And this now we have actually a two player game. What's it called? Badger and Coyote. Yeah, where you represent the two animal friends, Badger and Coyote, and what each has a little bit different. I don't know how the game works. I think it's one of those that doesn't like work. There's no like GM. I think it either walks you through some prompts or it gives you in some way a way to shape your story.
You go outside, you find an actual badger, an actual coyote,
that's
and you
right.
see what they do.
Oh, interesting. That's going to be dangerous. but yeah, there's like so many cool choices that all I can say is you just need to go ahead and come in and take a look. We've have over time made lots and lots of little note card signs for these that describe what the game is, so that in a pinch, you know, you can kind of find out the gist of a game just by looking at these cards. Some of the newest ones we're not going to have cards for yet, but that doesn't mean we don't already still have a lot. And we'll be getting, you know, new cards up as fast as we can.
Yeah. The particularly the ones I think that jumped out at me, the new ones. There's a couple noir games, one called Fedora Noir, one called Noir World, which is like the dungeon world but noir stuff.
Oh, cool. So that means it's Apocalypse World system.
And then there was that Price of Coal, which we just thought was really interesting.
Yeah, it is literally a game, though, that I think dramatizes, what was it like, sort of a coal miner's...
A dying coal miner town, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know, Union Resistance and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, one of your characters is a coal miner, and one of them is like the family of the coal miner or something.
Yeah it's again, these are actually some thoughtful games that will sometimes make you think about stuff more than you think. There's one that we talked about before that has touches on toxic masculinity by simulating a kind of a brutal Viking village where... You can vie for power, but there are consequences and to, you know, sort of things you might do. And, yeah, the game is themed around sort of an analysis of toxic masculinity. These are interesting improvisational stories. Some of them I feel like would be, like, cool, you know, things to do, like, in a classroom setting even, you know, like, or, you know, some university study or something. There's some cool ones in there.
That's our game stuff. Let's move on to news, and I think the thing to start with is that as we record this, yesterday was the 30th anniversary of the Batman animated series.
Yep.
Is that any good?
I heard good things.
probably the definitive Batman venture of all time.
Not just that, it also launched the Superman animated and the Justice League Unlimited, so basically that whole thing...
Well, yeah, DC became animated. Known for its animation because of that.
Yeah.
And really because of two men, Bruce Timm and Paul Dini. Paul Dini being sort of...
Three men, Dave. I think you're forgetting Batman.
I thought you were going to say Kevin Altieri or something.
No,
like that.
I'm saying Batman.
I'm like, look, that he contributed.
Yes, he did, with his batarangs.
Speaking of Batman, I don't know if people know this, and I do think our audience has probably all watched Batman the Animated Series, but if you haven't, man, it is the best perpetual vision of Batman you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing art, you know, it was influenced by stuff like the Popeye cartoons, Max Fleischer.
Yeah.
He did some Superman cartoons in the 40s that were little, like, sort of 5-minute action vignettes,
mm-hmm.
but, like, they had some really top-notch animation and storytelling. And so they took inspiration from that. They took inspiration from noir. They had the best voice casting. They had, that was Andrea Romano.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Shirley Walker doing the music.
Yep.
I mean, it was just like, it's like you took all the best people. And if you look at some of the voice cast, man, like Michael Ansara as Mr. Freeze,
yep.
like that single-handedly, I think, made that character viable.
Yeah.
Also, like, Conroy is who I hear when I read Batman.
Right, yeah. Kevin Conroy.
Mark Hamill's Joker.
Iconic. Yeah. Iconic.
So, hard question for you guys.
Yeah.
Favorite episode?
Heart of Ice.
Really? Interesting. I don't know if I have a favorite. I go, actually, very late in the run... The Over the Edge, the one where Batman has been dosed with the fear gas.
Oh, that one's
good.
And he
gets the vision of Batgirl being crippled.
She falls and, like, dies.
She dies, yeah.
She hits the, he's on.
He winds up at war with Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah.
That's
that
a great
really
episode.
I would probably... My inner child would choose the Hardack episode.
Hardack was cool.
Hardack's one of those things. They've never done that in the comics.
It's such a weird kind of sci-fi notion for Batman, and it's just
a way to do robots and a giant computer
and all that stuff. Was a, like an automaton.
Yeah.
It was just was a cool
nobody's
idea.
Favorite episode is the Underdwellers.
There's a few weird ones in there.
What about the Paul Newman-esque?
The one that was
Old
like
West one where.
Oh, wait, are you thinking about the one,
You're talking about Sundown, the one with Ra's al Ghul, are you?
Or are you talking about the one where he has to go to a work camp?
Yeah, the work camp.
What's the movie based on?
Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, Cool Hand Luke.
Those are both weird. You know what the thing is? Even those are good episodes.
They were just so weird. I was talking about
some of these, yeah, like, early on, they didn't have, like, they didn't quite know what they were really going to be good at.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, a lot of episodes had, like, casually better dialogue than normal, mm-hmm. casually cool scenes and all this stuff. One I want to quick mention that just happened to be playing in the store the other day was a late season one too, where what was it? Robin kind of falls for this girl with amnesia.
Yeah.
And she's being pursued by this big old thug.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's happening until at the very end of the episode, you find out that, I forget the exact details, but she is a split off portion of Clayface.
Yeah.
He was like, you know,
she's forgotten that she was sent out.
Right. It's like, it's like they grabbed him, but he like only was able to, like, his arm came off or whatever and like formed her. But because it didn't have the whole body, it kind of lost its memory.
Yeah.
And that was just like his escape thing. And so he just like absorbs her at the end. And this is at this point we've invested in this character.
Yeah.
Robin has kind of fallen for her.
Yep.
And she just like merges into him and like is lost forever.
Yeah.
That is some cool noir stuff.
Also, just Clayface as a character, I think, came into a lot of like
in the
great
80s
stories.
In the 80s, there were no less than three Clayfaces.
Yeah.
There was like the original one who was just an actor who murdered.
Yep.
There was the shape changer, and there was still another one.
Yep. Yeah.
And they like they codified it into the best version, which was they took like T-1000 morphing concepts. They kept the actor thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's also good on Harley Quinn. very different take. Very different take. But yeah, like that allowed them to do some amazing visuals, some body horror.
Speaking of animated series, introduced Harley Quinn.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Among the great stories would probably also be like their adaptation of Mad Love.
Oh, Mad Love.
Laughing Fish is great. Harlequinade is great.
Oh, Harlequinade is great.
That's the one where Batman and Harley have to like essentially team up.
I want to listen to the radio.
Yeah, I could probably name episodes for like an hour.
Yeah.
Is how many good episodes there are. In the off chance you haven't seen it, go watch it. Or if it's too many episodes, get like a best 20 episodes thing.
Streaming on HBO Max, right?
Is it HBO Max? Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, it leads. So from there, there's the Superman animated series. There's Justice League, Justice League Unlimited, Batman Beyond.
Yep.
Like, there was a ton of good stuff.
Yeah.
I agree. It's pretty dope.
All right, we got a couple trailers that we watched.
I just remember the one thing I wanted to mention when you mentioned Batman as the third partner.
Yes.
I don't know if people know this, but there was a time when Batman was likely to get canceled and not get a third season.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading at the time the Batman comic, and they announced it in that, and they're like, hey, if you want to save the show, write a letter to this address. I wrote a letter to that address, and I like kind of like wrote it like seriously, like this is, you know, a landmark show for animation and very serious stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then I got back, it didn't get canceled, so everybody can thank me for it because
Thanks, Dave. Among
the people that made, I was among the letter writing campaign that saved it.
Dave's letter did it.
But I got a thing back that was looked like an 8x10 glossy, like those kind of things, a headshot of Batman. It was that iconic shot from the opening where he's got like the red sun behind him,
mm-hmm.
And it was signed as if, not as if, by Batman.
Yeah,
and it said, "Thanks, Dave, Batman."
Yep.
So
that's awesome.
So yes, I know Batman was part of it. I've got his signature.
Oh, that's right. I mean, he was at least one of the producers.
What else do we have?
We have some trailers. There's a new trailer for John Hamm's Confess Fletch. This is now.
Do people nowadays even know who Fletch is?
Fletch is also like 30 years old, right?
Yeah.
Right. So it was. If you're gonna know about it through pop culture, you know it was like two Chevy Chase movies. If you could dig a little deeper, you'll know that it was based on a series of slightly tongue-in-cheek detective novels.
Novels called by Gregory MacDonald. About a investigative reporter. This sort of in the 70s, mm-hmm. when investigative reporters were more of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 80s, Chevy Chase they were very fun versions where he's like, his whole thing is like he's basically a bullshit artist in search of a story.
Right, and so he would bullshit his way into lots of different identities.
It was very much a Chevy Chase role.
It
was very fun. It was not super representative of the actual novels.
No.
And now we're getting...
It was a good depiction of it.
It was fun. I enjoyed it. This, however, looks much more in line with the novels, and John Hamm is a perfect cast for it. Because in the comics, he's supposed to be like an ex-Marine. Like, he's
built. I forgot that. He's not...
Like he's not a goober.
He's not the goober that Chevy Chase is.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the Fletch movies does have the unlikely Chevy Chase being like a woman. He's a womanizer. He's the hot guy. Then I'm like, nope, you're Chevy Chase.
Who can resist Chevy Chase?
Apparently.
And his delightful personality, apparently.
But anyway, this looks super fun. It's also a Mad Men reunion because
John Slattery
is playing his editor. Basically, Fletch is accused of a murder. and he is investigating this murder.
Yeah. How many murders has Fletch been accused of?
I think it's every book. I think it's every book.
This is like there being a mole at CTU in 24.
Yeah.
It looked cool, and it looked like it had like maybe a lean more and also to traditional mystery elements, which
it
is
does, yeah.
They straight up like give you the list of suspects and
well,
stuff.
And Marcia Gay Harden is in there.
Yep.
She's like chewing scenery like no one else.
She's always great.
Yeah,
but it also just kind of looks fun. I mean, it's also they didn't lose the humor. They just maybe tuned a little bit more to be a lot more like the book.
Right. It wasn't the character humor of Chevy Chase.
I'm here for the resurrection of whodunits.
Yeah.
I mean, Knives Out 2 is coming out.
Yeah.
The Glass Onion.
And who knows if anything will match up to Knives Out 1. But, man, if there is any sort of revival of whodunits, that's why.
Mm-hmm. We also got the trailer for My Best Friend's Exorcism. This is a adaptation of a book for Amazon Prime as a movie.
Yep.
A
book by Grady Hendrix, who's... Yep. Had sort of a popular series of sort of, I'd say, pop horror novels, starting with Horror Store, which was about the sort of haunted IKEA.
Southern Guides to Killing Vampires. He's written a lot of really good, and I think he's got a new one coming out fairly soon.
Solidly prolific. Nick has read the book.
Yep.
I started to read the book, but got sidetracked by life.
Yep.
You, I think, enjoyed the trailer, and I was, like, not loving it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I loved the trailer.
But you were saying, like, you see scenes directly from it.
Yeah, there were definitely scenes directly out of the book. And, like, the music is definitely music that's referenced in the book. I mean, honestly...
I think by setting the whole trailer to I Think We're Alone Now by Debbie Gibson,
mm-hmm.
Although I kind of remember it being brought up in the book... or maybe I didn't get to that scene. I don't know.
I think you're forgetting that every chapter is named after a song.
Is it?
Yeah.
But there's a difference between referencing a song and like using it as like the pop soundtrack to a whole trailer.
Right.
That's what I'm worried about. Is it looks a little too
Amazon Prime-y.
Maybe Amazon Prime-y. what's her name? Shellstrop. What's her name in The Good Place. To quote her, it looks ya basic.
I don't know. I didn't get that bad of a vibe.
The scary stuff wasn't as that scary, and I didn't think the funny stuff was that funny.
Yeah,
but
it could also just be a poorly constructed trailer, not wanting to give away a bunch of stuff.
It could be. But what if anything, it will prompt me to read the book. I will not see the movie unless people tell me it's surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Nick, you're probably going to watch this movie.
Press play.
Nick, press
especially,
play.
Especially if it's coming out before Halloween this year, I will definitely... There's a lot coming out before Halloween.
Coming out in November, we have the second trailer for Weird, the Yankovic Story. Which looks bonkers to me.
It does.
Well, it's been... We've kind of known it was going to be bonkers since they cast Daniel Radcliffe to play him.
Yeah.
And it looks like... we were trying to figure out the tone early on. We're like, is it going to be serious? Serious with some over-the-top stuff? Is it going to be completely over-the-top? And what it looks like, I believe it is going to be completely over-the-top mm-hmm. in a sort of weird way of, like, taking the tropes of, like, a biographical music artist
story
and showing, like, the out-of-control rock star and imagining that overlaid on the ridiculously nerdy and white bread kind of life of Weird Al, which is to say... They're like, we found out you were at a polka club.
Yep.
He has a secret affair with Madonna in the
secret.
80s.
She's his Yoko.
And he puts out, like, a cigarette on a dude.
Yeah.
But he's still kind of talking about the songs he does. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the actual music.
They famously did a VH1 Behind the Music on Weird Al, and it was the only one that didn't involve, like, drugs and alcohol. And
right, he's, like, kind of, he's pretty clean cut.
Yeah, and so this is basically his chance to sort of do that riff, which is kind of mm-hmm. funny.
It looks good. I wish it wasn't on Roku.
Yeah, it is weird.
I'm wondering if the whole movie is going to be like that, or if there will be like a framing device, like this is Weird Al telling his story, or someone else telling the story. Like, I wonder how they're going to, what they're going to use to bookend it or frame it or what.
I mean,
if they do.
This kind of makes sense, because UHF was this kind of movie.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that this is the kind of thing they would do.
Yeah.
It looks funny.
That's, I guess this is the only thing he's done other than UHF as a movie, right?
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about comics for the last 2 weeks. we're talking about comics for the last 2 weeks. That is Wednesday, August 31st, and Wednesday, September 7th.
Yep.
And
it was like a baby week last week and a solidly big week this week.
So yeah, we're just going to mix them together.
Yeah, all right, let's just all right. Do it then.
So let's start. We'll start with Marvel. Marvel's got All Out Avengers number one. It's sort of a classic big team. Captain Marvel, Thor, Iron Man, Captain America, Black Panther, Spider-Man.
Going against, like, plant-level threat, kind of.
Yep.
I think I can say that, like, because it's literally on page one, that, like, it begins with, I don't know what the deal is, but, like, a possessed Captain Marvel, like, at peak power, taking on the whole Avengers. It is an action-heavy Avengers book.
It is.
Yep. We got the new Alien number one. This is the same writer, Philip Kennedy Johnson. Has a kind of a fun premise. Basically, there's this world that was this science world that was overrun by aliens.
This is in the future that aliens normally takes place in ish.
2217.
Okay.
They call them the organisms now. That's what they code. So basically, there's this. It starts on this planet Europa 5. There are these like android this android kill team.
Yep.
That basically this general that used to work for obviously comes to find them and is like, yeah, we're desperate. We need your help. And basically, they need to run a sort of a suicide mission to prevent billions from starving.
Right.
They have to do it on this alien-infested world.
You said it was like an agricultural world that's like gonna be
irradiated and ruined. Yeah.
Right. So the aliens themselves—it's not like they're eating all the crops. They've wrecked something that's going to like unleash radiation or something.
No, they're just the radiation is on another planet.
I see.
There's
I see.
A cure for this radiation that the aliens are like the obstacle to get to.
Right on.
So it sounds like a fun, like, you know, I'm sure some of these characters will die. One person will have to sacrifice themselves to get the thing off the planet.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Who's the point of view character? Or is there, like,
the
team?
Androids. The androids are our point of view character.
Interesting.
So, yeah. From last week, we got Amazing Fantasy number 1000. That is one of these weird fuzzy math.
Yep, they took Spider-Man's first appearance in Amazing Fantasy 15 in, like, 1963, added up a bunch of Spider-Man comics that have come out since, and they're like, now it's on issue 1000.
Yep. this has it's an anthology, got a bunch of stories, fantastic creative teams.
It's one of those that's kind of like a tribute to the character as you get sometimes, but where sometimes those kind of suck, one is kind of good.
Yeah, so Michael Cho on art, Ryan Stegman, Olivia Coppier,
Small writer named Neil Gaiman.
Terry Dodson, Marco Cicchetto, Steve McNiven,
yep.
Jim Chung, all good artists. And then, yeah, Dan Slott returns for a story of an older Spider-Man that was interesting. Rainbow Rowell, Hoshi Anderson, Kurt Busiek, Armando Iannucci from In the Thick of It and Veep.
Oh, yeah.
Jonathan Hickman, Neil Gaiman, and again, Anthony Falcone, who I don't know who he is, but he writes the opening story. And it's basically about this thug who keeps getting beat up by Spider-Man. it's really good. Like, all these stories are really good. I enjoyed them quite a bit. It was a surprisingly good anthology.
I just want to point out that McNiven's artwork has never looked better, honestly.
Yeah.
I like it in more kind of rougher tone than his, like, Civil War days, which felt kind of a little Michael Turner-ish.
He definitely has... I think he's become less reliant on realism.
Yeah.
It's not that there's not a pretty realistic bent to his work right now, but I think he was, like, a little scared to get away from, like, not quite photo reference like Greg Land does, but little like that.
Yeah, a little like that.
There's a new Thunderbolts. This is Hawkeye leading a team. Thunderbolts were last seen in Devil's Reign. They were Kingpin's, like, anti-vigilante squad, composed of supervillains. This is Hawkeye trying to sort of... Hawkeye with new mayor, Luke Cage, trying to reclaim the name, because both of them ran a team of Thunderbolts at one point.
Oh, that's right.
And it's got an interesting lineup. It's got the new Power Man, it's got the Purple Girl, America Chavez, and Monica Rambeau.
Yep.
It's sort of the sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, reminiscent of that West Coast Avengers book that was out a little while back.
Right.
DC has a new all-ages book called Batman Nightwatch.
Yeah, it's like a Bat family book, but that's like specifically that all-ages friendly, kind of like Batman the Animated Series, but, you know, with a focus on the whole team of Batman, Robin, Batgirl, and anybody else?
Alfred, Penny One.
Do they call him that?
Uh-huh.
I don't care for that.
Well, you either.
Who was that? Scott Snyder?
That was a Snyder.
Son of a bitch.
Yep.
I think I won't forget that.
But also, they've got some kind of... Nightwatch is also like some kind of technology program they're using.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's an all-ages Batman book. DC's Saved by the Bell Rev.
Yep.
Is a their back to school special.
Yep. Do people remember that Bell Rev is the prison from Suicide Squad and a lot of other DC stuff? Well, it is. And what if it was saved by the Bell Rev?
Because I feel like the Suicide Squad movies have, like, Bell Rev has been used.
It's kind of true. And, like, I think it showed up on, like, Arrow and stuff like that sometimes.
People
know
it.
Which is wild to me because, like, as a kid reading Suicide Squad in the late 80s, early 90s, when it was essentially a cult book.
Yeah.
But very few people seem to know about it. It somehow managed to go 70 issues, but somehow also never got a lot of traction. It's shocking to me that the prison in it should be known, and the Suicide Squad and Amanda Waller should be known. But by the way, Amanda Waller continues to do very well and is being used to put to good use in DC's Dark Knights of Steel, her Game of Thrones version.
Yep.
So there's several stories in there: Gotham Academy story, a Super Son story, a Tiny Titan story. So a lot of characters make appearances in here.
I was joking as we were looking at it that there's stories that are very kind of fun and all ages silly, and then there's like a story about Azrael when he was training with the monks when he was like a like in his teens or like a child.
Yep, thrown in a coffin.
And they would put him in a coffin as punishment and like lock it closed if he was bad or whatever. And I was like, okay, so there's going to be different tones in this. Just a heads up.
Yep.
And like it actually like it looked like it was well done. Just boy, was that different from the cartoony Tiny Titans story right before it.
Yes. Does Mark Paul Gosselaar show up at any point?
Not that I've seen.
Okay.
Who dat?
From Saved by the Bell.
Oh.
Dave, oh, no. You mentioned Dark Knights of Steel. What is the one shot that came out this week?
It's called Getting There. There it is. Tales from the Three Kingdoms.
Yep.
And you know, I think when we saw the ads for this, it was kind of hard to know what it was like because the cover almost looked like a kiddie book.
Yeah.
Because it had like the young version of Kal-El and Bruce and Zara. What's her?
Kara Zor-El.
Didn't she have some different?
They call her Zara.
You're right. They call her Zara. Yeah. You're right.
Basically in their sort of medieval costumes, but it almost looked like it was like I thought it was going to be out of continuity or something. And instead, what this is a. It's a one-shot. Dark Knights of Steel is about like a little over halfway through its 12-issue run.
Yep.
We've already recommended it. It's the Game of Thrones of DC. It's really good. Not as dark as Game of Thrones.
No.
But with lots of neat world-building ideas. It's Tom Taylor who did Deceased and all that stuff. He likes to do world-building. And this just focuses on the sort of three different stories. It's kind of like, think of this as a good annual, I guess I'd say. Of like young of these characters when they were younger, and they're generally the children of like royalty and you know, there's sort of different rival families.
There's some cool ideas in there. There's a story about an orphanage that has like Two-Face and
well, it's Arkham. Arkham is not an asylum, but an orphanage in this.
Yeah.
And the characters like Two-Face are in there, but he's just Harvey there. He's just a kid who's got like a damaged face in these medieval times. Who else who do we got in there, Nick?
Penguin.
Yep.
And then Jimmy Olsen.
Yep. But it's not like Penguin in a tuxedo. It's Oswald Cobblepot.
It's this world's version of these characters.
Yeah.
And there's like you see that like Jimmy Olsen gets adopted by the Perry White family. Mm-hmm. But a mystery evolves when like what are kids being taken from the orphanage?
Yeah.
They're disappearing, and it's kind of like it's a known threat from a Batman book who's doing it. But I, of course, won't reveal. But there's some neat twists and turns, and a lot of cool world building in that and the other stories.
There's a Bane story that I thought was great.
Yep, and a story about like. Harley Quinn is like the jester in this to the L family, and it's like kind of jester in like that same sense as the fool in like Shakespeare stuff, where it's like kind of like a wise fool, like kind of known to occasionally drop some wisdom amidst the clown around. But it's like All Hallows Eve in the kingdom, and like a young Harley and Clark and Bruce. Go out to enjoy the festivities and end up running afoul of a gang of kid thieves, the Robins.
Yeah, who we know from the Darkness of Steel. He's recruited them all. It's pretty cool. I liked it.
Taylor does a really nice job of just world building.
I really enjoyed that.
And there are a few other writers in that mix, too.
Yeah.
It's not just Taylor, but and I was worried about that. I was like, I don't know if they're going to get the tone right, but I felt like these guys did.
Yeah, they all got the tone.
Yeah, it almost felt to me like, I was like, did they work from his notes? You know, like, sure, the writing styles are a little bit different, but, like, these ideas feel like they all very much fit.
They could have writer-roomed it or something.
Yeah, something like that. But I was honestly a little nervous about this one. I was like, oh, are they going to take a kind of a cool series and sort of jump the shark by having a spinoff before its time?
Just made it better.
But, yeah, instead it actually expands on some stuff. Like, in some ways, I feel like there's as much more world building in this one issue than several issues of the main series.
Sure. Yeah. We have the Harley Quinn animated series, The Real Sidekicks of New Gotham Special.
Yep.
This is a follow-up. We got the hardcover for Harley Quinn Eat, Bang, Kill Tour, which we sold out immediately and have more coming back in.
And that is based on the Harley Quinn animated series.
Yeah, new stories based on the animated series, and this is the same deal. It's a bunch of short stories. If you like the animated series, you'll probably like these. One of the writers of the animated series is writing it, I think.
As I recall, there are different art styles in there, but they're all pretty good adaptations of the animated series style.
Yeah, they're good. And then we've got Batman Dear Detective, which is a focus on... It's kind of an unusual project. It's black label sized. And I think it is a black label book. No, it's not, actually. So it's Lee Bermejo cover art. And I feel like some of these may be like original pieces. I can't quite tell. But his sort of like realism style.
Yeah.
And then a like Seven style, someone writing notes to Batman throughout.
Right. They like accompany some of the pictures and stuff like that. And we didn't have time to like read through all of them, but it looked like there's like a cipher you can learn from the villains, like almost their kind of Zodiac style notes, and we believe we have inferred what villain it is. But that is kind of one of the fun things, is trying to figure out what villain it is.
Yep.
But largely, this is an art book. You're getting all this really good art from Lee Bermejo, kind of doing the I feel like I'd say it's like the Christopher Nolan or the last Batman movie style of kind of a grittier Batman.
He did a Joker and a Luthor with Brian Azzarello. Like, people like his style.
Yeah.
His
if you don't know him by name, he's that guy who did the Joker thing.
A couple Star Trek books this week. Star Trek number 400, which they explained the math in an editorial.
Another fuzzy math, like add up all the Star Trek comics from DC to Marvel to whatever, and it's 400.
Another series of short stories from different eras. One of the stories is written by Will Wheaton.
Nice.
And does a prequel to the new Star Trek number 1 that IDW is going to be doing. So,
nice.
And all the variant covers, including the Lower Decks variant cover, are reprinted in the back of it. And then, from last week, Star Trek Picard Stargazer, which is a story that takes place between seasons 2 and 3 of Picard.
Right, it's like, I guess, so. And season 2 just ended, we haven't hit season 3 yet, so I guess, in its way, this is as good, this is like a, 2.5, you can check out, get some stuff going before they get around to season 3.
I really liked this first issue. I thought it was a good story.
I need to read it.
Yeah. I like the Picard, the prologue they did the original Picard series, too, so I think this might be...
Oh, yeah, that was good.
The same creative team, I think.
Yeah, that was the one that focused on the Romulans that he had saved during their time of crisis. Mm-hmm. And this, I know in focusing on it's going to have the Stargazer, his... the current version, I guess,
version
of what
ship.
Had been his original ship.
But there's also a flashback to his mission as, like, captain of the original Stargazer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Do you get to see the new Stargazer?
You do.
So for those who didn't watch Picard Season 1, Stargazer is, I think, kind of like the flagship of the Federation in that time.
Yeah.
The new Stargazer, and it looks dope. It's a cool-looking ship.
Yep. Also, y'all have seen that... when they were going to make him wear a toupee for...
Yeah, did
so they... So actually, when he's captain of the Stargazer, they have him in his toupee look.
Oh, that's
delightful.
Great.
It's a nice callback for the Trek fans. There's a new comic from Ahoy Comics called Highball that seems to be about a drunken Buck Rogers type. So if you like that kind of goofy sci-fi humor.
Huh?
Last week, they did reprint, alongside the Thunderbolts, they reprinted the Marvel Tales Thunderbolts, which has the first two issues of Thunderbolts... The Incredible Hulk, where they first appeared, and the Tales of the Marvel Universe, where they first appeared. So, like, some smaller stories you may not have seen with the Thunderbolts.
Right, but kind of a classic foundational stuff.
Yep. We got reprints of 8 Billion Genies, 1 through 4, so if you have missed any of that story, all four issues will be available.
Recommended. Is that Charles Soule?
Charles Soule. Yep. Ryan Brown.
Just really, as a really reminder, great. It's a story where every person on Earth gets one wish from a genie, and they all start going off at once, and all hell breaks loose.
Yes.
It's been a lot of fun.
And then we got a bunch of graphic novels. And so we have a new novel from Grant Morrison called Luda.
Yep. I don't know quite what to make of it, but I would say kind of magical realism. And it sort of sounded like a little bit about like the life of sort of like a pop celebrity type person. It made me think of Black Swan, the kind of weird dreamlike darkness of being on the cusp of fame.
A drag queen initiates her protege into the magical arts in this phantasmagoric epic from the legendary comics writer and New York Times bestselling author. That's Lucy LeBang. She's a star.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, so very Grant Morrison.
I mean, I'd say that name sounds silly, but we live in the world of Lady Gaga.
I mean, she's a drag queen. That's a drag queen name. We also have Dreams of Wakanda, where creators, writers, and comics legends write on the impact of Black Panther, the movie.
Oh, interesting.
This is like, basically it's a bunch of like essays about what, you know, what Black Panther means and that kind of thing.
I assume that will bring up, I'm going to forget what country it was, but it was like Saudi Arabia or something like that.
Yep.
Something that hasn't like shown like a Western movie in like decades. It became the first one that they showed.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is bonkers.
Listen, there's a poet who talks about embracing unity from Pittsburgh to Doha. There's someone who does a university class on the racial politics of Wakanda.
Bless you.
Thank you. There's you can see the T'Challa effect from the African American Film Critics Association. Afrofuturistic beauty from the costume designer of Black Panther.
Yeah, the Afrofuturism is a pretty big thing in the Black Panther movie, and certainly not the first example of it, but it was a very big example of it.
Someone writing on the music of Black Panther. It's interesting.
That's cool.
Along with that, because you can tell there's a movie coming, there is the Wakanda Atlas, which breaks down the geography of Wakanda.
Okay.
And then we've got She-Hulk, the complete collection. That's the Charles Soule run with Javier Pulido on art. It's good stuff. So if you've been enjoying the She-Hulk show, there's a trade collecting that. And then a couple weirder ones. Skybound has a original graphic novel called Everyday Hero Machine Boy, which looks like a android hero, kind of a Astro Boy kind of deal. It's apparently he has a karate grandpa. So this looks like wacky and fun, really nice art. And then a weird thing called How to Read Comics the Marvel Way, which has some classic Marvel comics in it, but also a sort of like a primer on how to parse comics. That's
interesting. Kind of thing. I do occasionally run into people who like they are literally confused or like, I don't know which panels to read first or how you do it. And I'm like, it's you know, just left to right,
yep,
top to bottom, just like a book. But manga sometimes can confuse, sometimes layout, some of the things that we take for granted, some little quirks of layout that we know are not always known. So I'd be curious to look at that and see its thing.
And then a fair amount of stuff that's like just stuff I've been reading. New issue of Batman by Chip Zdarsky, new issue of Poison Ivy, new issue of Sword of Azrael, new issue of Dark Crisis, new issue of Punisher, new issue of Moon Knight. I see a new issue of She-Hulk.
Yep. Sort of a big thing happens in that She-Hulk.
Okay.
One might have guessed that it was coming up, but it's still pretty big.
Does Jack of Hearts become a paralegal?
Jack of Hearts becomes romantically involved with She-Hulk.
Oh, that makes sense.
I assumed it was heading there. I just wasn't 100% sure. And I guess since this would be the final issue of what'll be in the trade, it goes farther than had previously.
Oh, all right. and that's comics of the week, I think. So we're gonna take a break, and then we're gonna come back and talk about some TV and some movies and a board game. Okay, so in the time since we last recorded, there have been some really notable TV shows that have come out.
Yep, like three big premieres at least.
So we're going to have spoilers for She-Hulk, House of the Dragon, and Rings of Power.
Yep.
If you've not seen them, we will spoil some things.
Yes. House of the Dragon, you mean Hot D.
Hot D, the official abbreviation for House of the Dragon. So before we talk about the two dueling fantasy shows, let's talk about She-Hulk.
Sure. I think we all liked it. All right, onward to the next one.
There have been four episodes so far? Or just three?
Three.
Just three, okay.
Yeah. I will say this. The other day, a friend of mine hadn't gotten around to it yet,
and is like kind of like not super hyped for it, and I was saying it's pretty good. But also the other thing of note is these are mostly like 30, maybe 40 minute max, I think, episodes. So it's like a real brisk show. It does unfold a little bit more in like a kind of a sitcom-y style, like or the traditional half hour comedy format. With a little bit more in, I think, the first episode.
The other thing is, I think it is legitimately funny. Like Marvel's done comedy stuff before it, but it feels like a sitcom.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, they're basically getting the half-hour sitcom in a way that WandaVision did.
Yeah.
From, like, the...
Yeah, but better.
Well, like, WandaVision
different,
was...
But they're coming from a different era. That was very, like, 60s-based. Yeah. This one is definitely more kind of 90s.
Wanda was 50s-based, then 60s-based, then 70s-based, then 80s-based, then 90s-based.
That's right.
They got them all.
They had them all. But at its most serious, it sort of starts out with the accident that leads her to get some of her cousin's blood in her. And that first episode has a lot of very fun banter and repartee. I would say a very sibling-type relationship between
for sure.
Bruce in, like, his, like, hole-up island where, like, he can go to, like, he has, like, a research station that Tony built him, and there's a bar there.
That they built together.
He's trying to, like, train his cousin Jennifer in how to handle being a Hulk.
How to Hulk.
Only, it turns out he's very good intentions, has a lot of good ideas, but also she's in a different situation.
She's a different kind of Hulk.
She's a different kind of Hulk,
good
and
Hulk
he's not ready
Hulk
for it.
For the day.
And they are both kind of pigheaded in a way, and they get annoyed at each other, and then they also bond, and they drink, and they talk about whether Captain America died a virgin.
That was hilarious.
That's great.
And then, this is one of the things I love, they get in a fight, and it's like a superhero comic book fight with, like, hand clap, you know, shockwaves.
Great.
Yep.
Throwing people into trees, you know, like punches and stuff like that. I mean, it's still treated in a kind of light way because you know that they can take it and it's not really hurting them that much. But I love it because it's just like it would be like a sibling scrap. It's just when you're superhero siblings, this is what it looks like.
Her version of the Hulk hand clap was amazing.
She did a cool thing. She did it rhythmically so that it, or like, you know, with a pulsed it so that it's like keeps them off their toes. I'm like, that's cool. If you were playing a video game, that would be like unlock the, you know, off balance shockwaves or something like that. That it'd be a different type of clap attack.
Clap attack is a different thing.
I had that taken care of with a shot, it flares up once every year or two.
First episode also introduced Titania.
Briefly.
With her weird
very
American
briefly.
Accent.
Yep.
But yeah, like for those who haven't watched, it does. You know, once She-Hulk's kind of got a handle on things, she tries to go back to her normal life. She just wants to be a lawyer. She wants to be Jennifer Walters, but once she has to in the middle of a court big room because Titania comes smashing through
to kill the jury
she has to Hulk up and save him, and instantly she's kind of a subject of media gossip and celebrity, you know, fascination. And they label her She-Hulk, which she doesn't like. I thought that was a pretty good way to handle it, but it's like, well, once it sticks, you can't change the name of what you are in pop culture. She kind of goes back, but she does go back to her life. It's just that her life is turned upside down now, and that's like the series.
Yeah,
I love the little things. Like, she can drink as much as she wants to the Hulk, but if she turns back, she's still got deal with the hangover.
Yeah. She gets like the hangover.
I love Nikki. I don't think Nikki's in the comics. I think her paralegal isn't that a new character.
I think it is,
and she's great. Like, I really love that. But Pug is from the comics, and he is also great.
He is also great.
Their version of the superhuman law division of GLNK, which is from the Dan Slott run, really good.
Mallory Book
shows up.
I love that she shows up in like 5 seconds. Yep. She's like, nope, out.
That's Angelica Schuyler.
Where is she from? Or what is she
from? Hamilton.
Hamilton, that's right.
But also Girls 5 Eva.
Yeah.
What you have is like a kind of a legal drama that is very lightweight kind of legal drama with big superhero stuff. Fourth wall breaking, because
she does that all the time.
Including a great bit in the current episode where... she mentions that she's going to have to try to bring in sort of as a character witness Wong, you know, the current Sorcerer Supreme.
So as she's driving, she takes her hand off the wheel and turns to us and is like, look, I know you all want to see Wong. This isn't going to be a cameo show. Remember whose show this is. It's not going to be a cameo every week except for Bruce and I guess Emil and Wong. But remember whose show this is.
That's great.
And by the way, Tim Roth. Tim Roth getting to play Emil Blonsky.
Right. Her first big trial is to exonerate the Abomination, aka the dude her cousin fought in the first Hulk movie.
Well, they've given him the Trevor treatment here, where he's just this complete slacker. He's got 7 soulmates. He's going to live on a farm.
He essentially became New Age religious and kind of in jail. Does seem to have legit reformed.
But he wrote some very heartfelt haikus.
He wrote some very heartfelt haikus, including, an apologetic haiku to Bruce.
Yeah, I thought that was amazing.
Which apparently Bruce saved, which I thought was delightful.
Yeah, that's great.
And he has, like, essentially, in the tradition of, like, women falling for weird serial killers and stuff in prisons, through the pen pal program, he's got a sort of a bunch of groupie acolytes.
Yeah, I'm very excited when he turns into the Abomination.
I noticed that. The bit of the trial where he's like, he's helped a prison guard deal with his divorce.
Yep. Oh yeah.
They're making toilet wine kombucha. They did so much to redeem the Hulk movie, which I think was seen as sort of the black sheep of the MCU.
Well, even the line about I was another
I was a different person.
Yeah, I was a different person was great.
I think was it Eli Roth?
Tim Roth.
God, I always keep mixing those guys up for the end of
totally
time.
Totally different people.
Tim Roth seems to be having a lot of fun playing the sort of chilled out version of the human side of Abomination.
Benedict Wong seems to be having a great time playing Wong, who they've really have. Like, the MCU version of Wong just is so much better than
he's become the new Coulson in
he's
a lot of
great.
Ways.
Oh, yeah.
He's great.
So let's talk about the actress playing Jennifer Walters.
Tatiana Maslany knew she'd be great at this, and of course she is.
Well, I mean, she was amazing in Orphan Black.
Yeah.
Right, and I didn't watch that, but for those of you who didn't, apparently she played a bunch of clones and did an amazing job. So amazing playing these different incarnations.
You forgot it was the same actress.
That you'll forget it's the same actress. Yeah. And I believe it. I've seen clips and stuff, and of course she...
That was a darker show, but she could be funny there too. But she also had a short-lived role on Parks and Rec where I could see that where I saw that she could be funny.
Yep. And so she plays both the sort of, I'm going to say sort of headstrong and snarky Jennifer Walters side of things.
Yep.
And then the sort of the more big brash She-Hulk. I mean, same person, but just different vibes kind of off of them. And she seems great at playing both. She's got a good sense of comic timing.
Yeah.
Criticisms. Do we think the CG could stand to be a little better?
CG could stand to be a little bit better, but mostly I forget about it.
It's one of those things, like, if this had been, like, just a few years ago, like it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's just...
And there's a lot of it, too.
Spoiled. And there's a lot of it.
Right, and I do think, we've kind of gotten spoiled. I do think you may be right, Randy, that they're kind of, like, always pushing their visual effects artists to do another pass, and that's why it's late sometimes.
Like, we have to release it on Thursdays. We need that one more day, man. Like, it is crazy.
But,
I mean... What other we have not we haven't seen anyone twerking with Megan Thee Stallion besides She-Hulk. So.
No.
Nope.
Honestly, if the show was just okay, I think I might be a little bit more bothered by it. But the show is so good.
The show's
just,
great.
Just
right.
all around the writing, the jokes land.
Yeah.
The performances are great.
This week's whole thing with Dennis, her like entitled male coworker. And her having to get up the stand and talk about how delusional he was under oath.
And the light elf.
And the light elf.
I thought that was both funny and a neat way to integrate MCU history. So everybody knows that Asgard now has, like, its actual place, like, on Earth.
Yep.
Like, new Asgard. And, yes, it turns out, like, that one of the skeevy lawyers she used to work with dated someone he thought was Megan Thee Stallion, but was in fact a transformed elf from New Asgard, and that's the current plot line, and trying to resolve that, and issues of, like, money he spent on her, and getting compensation for it.
$175,000.
But, you know, the show is also, what I love, one of the things I love about its sense of humor is it's pushing back against some of the sort of, what would I say? The butthurt incel side of the Marvel fandom. The guys who whine anytime that a woman does anything in a Marvel movie. They straight up parodied them by having a montage of people like posting like harsh internet comments about her, where they're like, "So wait, they took Hulk's manhood and gave it to a woman?"
It's
hilariously lampoons them.
Yeah.
I
love this show. I'm very much on board.
Can we talk about the appearance in the last episode? the people who tried to steal She-Hulk's blood.
Oh, the Wrecking Crew?
Yeah, the Wrecking
Crew. You know, it's actually one of the few things that I potentially didn't like if I thought that that was all we would ever see of them.
I think it's possible.
Because the Wrecking Crew are some of the great bruiser villains in comics, and these guys were a bunch of doofuses.
I think this is them at the very beginning.
I don't even know if it'll still be them. Like, I feel like those weapons could end up in other people's hands.
Exactly.
And they could be, like, a real Wrecking Crew.
But I love the idea that they just stole stole Asgardian, construction equipment.
Yeah. Asgard or something, yeah.
Just make it the simplest thing as possible.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. They mentioned the boss. Do you figure Titania hired them?
See, everyone's doing that, and I'm like, yeah, you could, but if you wanted to tie things in, you could do Power Broker.
Did they show up?
Well, that's true, because they were trying to get her blood.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that doesn't seem like something Titania would be trying to do.
Unless she wanted to boost her superpowers because she got her butt kicked by S.H.I.E.L.D.
Right.
Maybe so.
I mean, you could easily do it as Titania, and it would work fine.
Like, Titania's big thing in the comics is that she's the girlfriend and eventually wife of Crusher Creel.
Right.
Yeah. So it makes sense to tie her into, like, the Wrecking Crew and then have Crusher Creel be part of it or something like that. You know, he's also a construction worker with
Iron. I mean, they do outright call themselves, like, one of them is Bulldozer.
Yeah,
and
they
Thunderball.
Call out the names, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm hopeful they get a power upgrade and we see them again in a later date.
I think, here's the thing, I do think that they are treating, like, we're going to get Frogman. They're clearly treating everyone that shows up in this as sort of a D-lister. So I do feel like they may be treating the Wrecking Crew as D-listers.
Yeah, that's a rare mistake, I would say, because the Wrecking Crew deserve their A-list status.
The Wrecking
status.
Crew has been around since, what, the 50s?
I'm going to say, Dave, while I share your appreciation for the Wrecking Crew, I don't know if they've ever been an A-list. A-list, maybe.
I think they were A-list in Thor. They're not, like, master villains, but I say, if you're looking for, like, blue-collar, roughneck-built villains...
They're good goons.
Who's better?
They're good goons.
No, they can... These guys are A-list, like...
What about Ox?
Singly, these guys took on, like... Like, the Wrecker alone took on Thor back in the day, and, like, you know, when they're all working together, they're supposed to be pretty powerhouses.
I guess. I was thinking of when I saw them, when I remember them, was from the Mansion Siege, when they were basically goons who helped beat up Hercules.
I mean,
they did beat Hercules into a coma.
They did, but then...
It was the worst he'd ever been hurt.
It took all of them, plus Goliath.
Yeah, well, you know, he's a hero.
That's true. Anyway, I'm loving the hell out of this show.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
The post-credit sequences have all been really funny, too.
Yeah.
Her doing stuff around the house. I love seeing superheroes do mundane stuff and that...
having to carry water bottles?
Yes. and hang a TV.
Her, it's her dad, right? Is played by the guy who was Cousin Larry on Perfect Strangers.
Yes.
Yeah,
he's great.
As you say, sitcom royalty, Randy.
Yep, yep. All right, let's talk about fantasy shows. Let's talk about the lesser one first, and that is Hot D.
Yes.
Right. I think we all kind
House of the Dragon.
Agree with this, although I will say I'm enjoying it.
I'm enjoying it, but this is my thing, and I keep saying... And this sounds more harsh than I mean it to. But the truth is, I like it, but if they cancel it tomorrow, I wouldn't care. And so that is kind of the problem.
I've only seen the first two episodes.
I've seen half of the third.
Oh, okay.
There's a sort of notable thing in the third, which I thought was almost a little too melodramatic for Game of Thrones. Which isn't to say that, like, Game of Thrones doesn't do melodrama, but it's kind of a... I don't see this particular thing happening. It's, like, slightly action tropey.
Time-traveling Ned Stark with a railgun.
It's not that.
Okay.
It's Tony Stark with a railgun.
Time-traveling Tony Stark with a railgun. Tony Stark revealed to be part of this House Stark.
Let's just do a quick overview. It's set some hundreds of years in the past.
170-something?
Something like that, yeah.
From what we know.
It's focused on House Targaryen.
It's focused on House Targaryen, and this is at a time when they kind of like, it's like Caesar, it's like they control the known world.
They are the Lannisters at this point. They
But bigger than that, like the Lannisters were already like, they were being chipped at, and this is like, they pretty much are running the show.
They have the Iron Throne.
They have dragons, and as the opening narration suggests, it's like the only potential real threat is civil war within, fighting over the throne, which we know is going to happen.
And the crab feeder.
He is there's like an alliance of what do they call it? The Triarchy.
Yeah.
I forget who all it is, but it's essentially alliance.
House Greyjoy, right? Aren't they the
is that what the deal is?
The seafaring people.
But like, who are the?
But I don't know at that point if they.
I don't either.
I bet you might be right though. Who are the three people that make up the Triarchy, though?
What Triarchy are you talking about?
That's in the third episode.
Oh, is it? Yeah. I thought they were talking about it as far back as
at the end of the second one. There's only the Daemon and the other.
They're not the Triarchy.
Okay.
No. The Triarchy is the crab feeders people.
That's mentioned in episode one.
Is it mentioned in episode one? Mm-hmm. I didn't catch. They focus more on episode three.
Yeah, they did. It wasn't a big thing.
How should we know? All these
but it's like some. It'd be like small kingdoms uniting.
Small kingdoms trying to overthrow the
free cities and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe so. And the Targaryens is all focused on there's a king. Who's getting a little older,
right?
Loses his child to a miscarriage.
Right, he's been waiting for years to have like a son to take on his lineage and take the Iron Throne. And unfortunately, the closest he has a son born who dies shortly after birth, and his wife dies in childbirth
because they do a medieval C-section trying to save the baby. Yep. That was one of the hardest scenes to watch.
It was difficult. I have read how they particularly wanted to consult women on this, and that broadly they kind of got the go-ahead from everyone who was their consultant.
Yeah, I mean, very, very, very bloody, very dark.
It was difficult. I would say, for anybody who was, pregnant or anything like that, or had any difficulties, it might be triggering.
That is my gripe with Hot D so far.
Yeah.
And it was my gripe with Game of Thrones. They're so invested in how dark and bloody and incest is a thing, and child brides, and I'm like, I get that you're trying to do the sort of realistic thing. I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
And I think that was what was refreshing about the books the first time, but I think at this point, it feels gross to me.
In the original books, I mean, they aged them up for the show.
Yeah, because
they were supposed to be super young, and they were talking about marrying off Sansa at, 12
And I don't like that they've swung into that. I get it, that's kind of the thing, but this is an adaptation of a history book. They could definitely... They had a lot more flexibility, and I still feel like they swung a little hard into the grosser parts.
Here's the thing is, I feel like Game of Thrones is... It does lean... It is a little bit of a sex and violence show. It'd be like... you don't, go to a Paul Verhoeven movie and be offended if somebody's head gets blown up.
That's true.
It's the tits and blood show.
But that's just funny.
Paul Verhoeven, he is the king of funny violence.
And I will say, though, there are still scenes in here that are, really well, super well done. Yeah.
It's pretty inexpensive looking.
Siege on the bridge in the second episode.
Yeah. Also, Matt Smith is playing a great, I guess he's one of the villains.
He's definitely villainous. He played a straight, I can only say he was the captain of the guard for the City Watch.
Yeah.
And he, his first move is essentially a crackdown on, what I would say would be street crime, mm-hmm. of, cutting off the hands of people.
It's really just anybody.
If you want to think about, having, a connotations with modern times, it'd be this is an overzealous militarized police force. Mm-hmm. That is just brutalizing the population.
But he is the smarmy brother of the king who has been kind of pushed off to the side.
I like the way they've handled the king because he's a difficult one to know. Where he's he seems a bit of a weak king at some point, but not completely weak, not a cliche weak. He's somewhat easily manipulated.
The king addicted to his Legos.
But he's also trying to. He does want his daughter to have a good life. And he tries to give the throne to her.
Patty Constantine. Is it Constantine? That's the actor who plays him. He's a good actor.
He is good.
Good job. There's some good stuff in the third episode, too, when you get to that, Nick. And I like the actress playing his daughter, who's one of the lead characters. Yeah. And she does have the throne sort of given to her, but it becomes more complicated even in the third episode, where we hit the first of what we know are going to be, I think, at least two time jumps. And we're going to see these characters probably portrayed, some of the younger ones probably by new actors eventually, but not yet in the third episode.
Yeah.
Let's see. But yeah, Matt Smith is doing a good job as the kind of watchably skeevy brother.
I guess I'm running into the same thing around with Game of Thrones where it's like, there aren't any heroes. Everyone's terrible. And I think we don't have a Tyrion. We don't have anyone who's kind of having fun with the whole thing.
I do think it could use a Tyrion. At the same time, I'm sometimes there's just not a Tyrion.
Well, also, and this, we're sort of laser focused on something. Yeah. Where Game of Thrones was definitely more expansive, where you got to see the Wall and then Dragonstone and then Castle Rock. This one, we're focused just on King's Landing.
I will say they bring in another royal house that you'll recognize in the third episode.
Yeah, okay.
So they are slowly expanding.
And we're starting to see see, like, the, like that fight with the crab feeder and stuff like that is, like, we're starting to see more of it. It's a pretty big thing in the third episode.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we see dragons here and there. Yep. They look good, I think.
Yeah. We were talking with a customer yesterday, and he was liking the sort of more serpentine look of these dragons. They, like, kind of look a little bit more like if you've ever seen medieval art of dragons, where it almost looks like giant serpent snakes with legs.
If you listen to the sound editing, each of the dragons have, like, a unique sound and voice to them, which I think is really, really cool.
Hello, dragon here.
The only reason I know this is because I'm listening to a podcast that are, like, deep diving into the episodes of House of the Dragon, and also the next show we're going to talk about, and the sound editor who's doing all the sounds for all the various things are doing the sounds on also the Rings of Power.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm learning a little bit more into that. I forget her name who's doing all the sound editing, but she's apparently very, very...
Nick, do you feel like, are you on board House of the Dragon?
I am. I'm not in love with it, but the second episode had a lot more to like. It is a lot of people just sitting in rooms talking. And I don't really have an issue with that. I find the stuff compelling, especially when you're dealing with, like, Rhys Ifans and his sort of bid for the throne, who plays, is it Otto Hightower?
Yeah, yeah, the King's Hand, who kind of creepily, I can only say... quietly pimps out his daughter.
Yeah.
But like, I kind of, like, I was clever how that happened, because it was while the king was grieving his wife, and she was, like, this just there to pick him up and talk to him initially, and but clearly gets under his skin.
Yeah.
I was like,
she gives him a dragon.
Sneaky, sneaky move. I don't know. I can't quite figure her out. She's broadly seems to be. I don't think she has any big grand aspirations. I think she's doing the best she can for her family right now and doing this, and she happens to be pretty good at the sort of politicking side of it.
I mean,
like, she plays them like a fiddle.
Oh, yeah.
Or a harp from hell, if you will.
But I feel like she's just doing her father's bidding at this point.
Right. I don't think there's, like, particular malice in her, or, like, she's not quite a puppet master. But kind of when you live that life, you could become that.
Yeah.
And in the third episode, you see that there is this gulf between her and, I can't say the name of the Targaryen girl.
Rhaenyra?
Rhaenyrs?
I'm gonna say it's Rhaenyra, I think.
It begins with an R. It's something like that, yeah.
A gulf has grown between them, because she continues to be kind of like, I don't want to get married to anybody. I don't want to be part of all of this politicking. And she also, like, she's hurt that her dad always wanted a boy, right?
Yeah. Well, on that bridge, I mean, she outright tells Matt Smith to kill her. I mean, if you want the throne, just kill me and just be done with it.
That's a pretty dramatic confrontation. The fact that Matt Smith does seem to care about her is one of his most redeeming qualities. He's otherwise pretty bad person.
He is essentially this show's Jaime Lannister.
Yeah, it's gonna be hard to quite know where he's headed one way or the other. All right, but I kind of agree with you, Randy. It's one of those things where, right at the moment at least, if it disappeared, I wouldn't exactly be heartbroken.
And also, like, HBO definitely tried to launch this to try and undercut Rings of Power a little bit. Like, the timing was not accidental.
No.
And I don't think it worked for them, because Rings of Power came out strong.
25 million people watched the first two episodes, and that's...
And here's the thing, like, of the three of us in this room, I am the hater. On our spectrum, I hate it. Because we're binary.
But your particular hate happens to be, I like it pretty well.
I really liked it. Yeah, it's really good.
So this is Lord of the Rings stuff. Rings of Power, I believe, could be, like, easily, like, 1,000 years. Like, the Second Age, I believe, is when it's set in.
Yeah.
Not the Third Age of most of the movies.
Basically, Morgoth has just fallen, and Sauron...
I should say, Morgoth is the big bad, the Lucifer,
he's
Prince of Darkness, worse than Sauron, but once he is toppled, Sauron rises to similar levels of power. And we're pretty sure we're going to see that chronicled... But there's kind of some mysteries as to exactly who's what and what's happening.
I love how this opens with Galadriel in the... What do they call it? Their homelands.
The
elf... Like, where they get... Basically go to...
Valinor?
Valinor, yeah.
Yeah.
It was cool to see Valinor, because I don't think we've ever seen it.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that was in the era, as she notes, when there was not even yet a sun, and it was like there's sort of like the magical trees and stuff like that are...
the silver and gold, they're basically life trees.
Yeah. That sort of create this magical light, and she is on the hunt for Sauron, who had killed her brother, or like his armies had?
Well... his armies had. I think in the book he was killed by a werewolf, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's one of those things where, like, they may use the word werewolf, but I think he meant sort of like more like the wargs, you know, like a heightened wolf, but not like
I guess Morgoth and Sauron are like controlled beasts and like animals and stuff like that. So I know, I guess they were like wolf killed him or something.
My knowledge of the lore is frankly weak. I haven't read the Silmarillion. I was one of those people that found it too boring. Although I this may prompt me to, but. But yeah, she's like, they're in these cool icy wastelands. It's like they've got picks, like they're going up this ice wall. And she is, like, driven.
She's sworn an oath to basically find her brother's killer at any cost.
And the other elves are like, we need to turn back.
Young Galadriel is badass and is my favorite part of this show.
She's intense.
Nick, you were talking about how she, like, reflects sort of the mannerisms and... sort of some of the like facial tics or like things of
Cate Blanchett. Yeah, well, there's specifically when Cate Blanchett is offered the ring in Lord of the Rings, and she kind of like gets this kind of darkness around
when
her.
she talks about what it would be like if she took it.
There are moments where you can sort of see that intensity. Glimmer of intensity.
Even though, what would you say the actress is like that? Like in human years, how old is like that actress? 20s.
Yeah, 25. Yeah, late 20s probably.
And you'll see younger characters in this. She is one of several like characters that live a long ass time. Elrond is the other one.
Elves live forever.
Yeah, they can potentially, I think, be immortal, but they can be killed, of course. But yeah, Elrond, if she's sort of the warrior of the era, which I believe, you know, is like, I don't know if there's much at all in the lore that Tolkien would use, which often had those kind of like sweeping era of myth. And it's like, then did Galadriel come to this land and you know, and she sought the library of so-and-so. And I'm like, well, you're not saying much about her. That was just the style of kind of, he wrote in this mythic writing. But I think in a way that gives him lots of wiggle room as far as the stories they want to tell. So they portray her as the warrior and the younger
Elrond.
He's a politician in the making.
So yeah. I heard this because I was looking online just for random like facts and stuff, and I saw somebody compare Elrond to Sam Seaborn from West Wing.
Yeah,
he's kind of like the screenwriter with like, which I've.
It's not the craziest thing.
No, just like because the compassion like that he was writing. No, he there was like heart and compassion behind the words he was wanting, and like him like. Mouthing the words that the king was saying
while he was like giving a speech.
I was like, that makes perfect sense.
I just watched Hamilton the other day, and when George Washington, when he writes the farewell speech of George Washington, there's a thing where he's reciting it, and George Washington begins to say it at the same time as they overlap. And it's a neat bit. I like the guy playing him. And they also are, there's a kind of constant reminder that the elves of Tolkien are kind of, they're all badasses.
Yeah.
Like, they sort of, you know, dwarves kind of scoff at them and, like, might call them skinny and stuff like that. But they can, like, match just about anybody. And so when he goes in the second episode to visit Durin, his dwarf friend, who...
Khazad-dûm.
In Khazad-dûm, a.k.a. future home of the Balrog.
Yep.
who will later be called Durin's Bane.
So you think Durin's going to wind up, it's going to be good for Durin? Is that what you
could do? the dwarves delve too deep and too greedily. but aside from the fact that the dwarven kingdom looks utterly jaw-droppingly amazing, like the best version of a dwarf kingdom I've ever seen, honestly.
Yeah, that was cool.
Better than the movies, better than Peter Jackson stuff.
I heard in some of the press that they were trying to make the dwarves like the badass that they should be.
Yeah.
So I don't know the Lord of the Rings all that well. Is Elrond, are they forging the rings? I thought that was Sauron who does that.
I think he does forge them, but they've brought up Celebrimbor, who's the master smith, and I forget what the deal is. I feel like he had a role in it. Like he assisted Sauron, didn't realize it was, you know, for evil stuff.
Because I think Sauron basically came under in like a disguise in a lot of ways, and sort of
he was, I think, thought to be he beguiled people.
Yeah,
so that's what that brings us to the wizard man.
Right, there is a there at one point one of the something else we'll have to quick mention is the Harfoots, the wilder hobbits tribe. Of the time that seemed that they're like nomads, right? They travel around and set up these cool.
The world building here is really cool because
tree camouflaged houses and stuff.
Yeah, because they don't want to involve themselves in anything.
Yeah.
They're essentially like, we only care about ourselves.
In that sense, that fits the Hobbit that we know. It's just that these guys do it not by being homebodies in the Shire.
Yeah.
They kind of travel around and try and avoid stuff.
Yeah.
And one of them says something like, the stars are wrong, or there's something wrong with the sky. Yeah. And indeed, we see, like, this falling star, you know, that, you know, you're going to definitely think of, like, Christian symbolism of, like, fallen angels. Because yep. there's a big crash in a fiery pit, and there's, a naked dude that lands in it. But he has, like, what looks like could be the tousled hair of a younger Gandalf.
Yep.
And yeah. I'm not convinced that it's not the transformed... what is he called? A Valar, I think. These sort of angelic-type spirits that of Tolkien's cosmology.
Right.
And I'm like, maybe that is what it's meant to be like when you transform and you kind of don't remember everything, except there's some kind of creepy stuff.
And I read it as just Sauron.
Right. And I don't, like, that. Maybe that's obvious.
Because when he crashed that last thing where they zoom out from the impact crater, it definitely looked like the eye.
Right. And yeah. I think I just didn't notice that.
I think you may be right, Nick. I think that might be what it is.
It would make sense. It makes sense. These poor Harfoot's Hobbit, and I love the lead actress.
She's great.
Lead Harfoot.
Yeah.
She's real. She's like, you know, kind of in a lot of ways. These characters, in the first episode, they seemed a little flat to me, like just kind of one note. But the more I spend time with them, the more I like them. It's kind of like, you know, like Merry and Pippin are not exactly deep characters, but you like spending time with them. Everybody kind of, like, you know Gandalf's deal right off the top. As soon as you meet him, you kind of know what he's like.
Yep.
But he's nuanced in his portrayal, and I feel that way about a lot of the characters. So her exuberant, you know, goes too far beyond the bounds of where they're supposed to. She's the adventuress.
Yeah, she wants the berries in the farm it's not supposed to be there. But
and what do they see out there? Like a big, it looked like a dire wolf.
Yeah, it was one of the wolves.
Yeah,
it was creepy looking. And let's quick pause and talk about some of the scarier stuff in this. There's like an seemingly like a hidden orc army traveling underground and like digging underground and like making villages disappear, and they're creepy.
They are,
because this this one elven warden kind of guy who's the internet is freaking out because he has darker skin.
Well, that was also the Harfoots too,
and some of them, not all of them, but yeah, some of them. That's the stupid internet for you. This guy is he's like a stoic badass, and he's also can't confess his love to a human that he's known.
I like this idea that the elves are sort of like positioned to watch over the humans because they can't trust them.
It reminds me of how the Vulcans were handled in Enterprise. Vulcans, who are sometimes have been jokingly called the space elves, because they are somewhat paternalistic at times. Like they do have a little bit of that. We know better than you. We're an older race. And yet at the same time, there's clearly a lot of unfair sort of prejudice against them.
Yeah.
But the orcs are creepy.
This guy is down there, and
orc fight with the two like commoners is great.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that was great. And when the elf guy, the elf warden dude is down in there, it'll evoke like sort of like a tunnel rat in Vietnam. Like it's scary down there. And you're like, what's moving? There's also an ice troll or whatever they called it in that first episode that looked dope.
I guess the only thing, of course, we have to cover is the person who's on the shipwreck with Galadriel, the human whatever he is.
He's got a name, because when I pause it, it says it, but I was like, I actually thought at first that it was like a young Aragorn, because Aragorn is a long-lived guy. He's a Dunedain.
Oh, really?
I don't think he's that long.
But it's not that long. Yeah. He just reminded me of him. But because I don't know the lore
it'll be like his grandpappy.
I mean, it could be. Or it might be this guy will end up like a founding ranger
I'm curious, do you guys think that they will be bringing them all together? Like, are all these characters going to be disparate around the world, or are going to all be brought together in like a big D&D party style thing?
I don't think they're going to form a big D&D party, but I think they're going to interact.
Okay.
Because I don't think there's like a famous adventure, or like, I think it'd be stretching it if there's like Galadriel and a Hobbit and Sauron and Sauron, who we don't know is Sauron, I mean, and Elrond and stuff like get together. I think it's going to be a little more like Game of Thrones, where disparate events end up intertwining here and there.
Okay. Gil-galad? Isn't that...
Or Gil-galad.
Gil-galad.
He's shown up before. He's one of the big elven...
Buck Rogers, right? Gil-galad?
He's the one with Galadriel.
Not on the ship.
Oh, not?
No, he's an elf.
Oh, okay.
Now, the guy on the ship who's kind of like... What is it? He's not
Hellbrand.
Yeah, I don't. That name doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay,
that's a manga, right? Hellbrand.
They've mentioned. I think I've heard them mention some of the kind of like the gods of Tolkien. Like mention some of them.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else? There's a big sea serpent.
Yeah, that was cool.
I've heard from at least one customer who felt they were kind of running roughshod over Tolkien's lore. And I'm just briefly chatting with my brother, who knows the lore pretty well. I think he's been much more open to it. You know, kind of. I think it's one of those things where there's like, if you sort of do the charitable thing and like read of it, I think you can find that wiggle room in it. Well, but I'm curious to read more on it.
Like Peter Jackson kind of run roughshod over kind of the Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
I know that like one of the things that there's like, well, like one of the customers said that like a lot of the stuff that's taking place in Middle Earth proper is supposed to be taking place on Valinor.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's notable. Like, I guess that's a fair criticism if that's, you know, if they've moved a lot of stuff from one place to another that should have been in, like, the elf lands. but I will say this. I have just found it much more exciting than I thought it was going to be to see some new new stories set in Middle Earth and not know what's going on and have some mysteries, even though so much of it is set and, you know, already laid down.
Yeah.
It's kind of like big points here and there, but like what happens between point A and point B and what the people were like when it was happening is, I think, all unknown. And, yeah, and like that's room for them to tell a lot of different kind of stories.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm not, as we know, I don't like elves so much. But I'm enjoying the first issue. I like the first two episodes quite a bit, so.
Yeah, it has the feel of something new, and at the same time of reminding me of the thing that I liked, the best stuff in Peter Jackson's.
I think between Hot D, Rings of Power, and the D&D movie coming out, we may be hitting another fantasy renaissance.
Yeah, the D&D could be there repping the kind of like fun, you know, like kind of modern fantasy, you know, the snarkier, you know, more fun side of it. You know, Game of Thrones gives us our R-rated exploitation fantasy, and then you've got the sort of noble epic fantasy with Tolkien, but also also moving forward with that, some progressive stuff that's pissing off, I'd say, the right people.
Yes.
Exactly. Yep.
I laugh at their tears and enjoy the adventures of the Harfoots.
And wish Galadriel upon them.
Yes.
So I played a board game I've been meaning to play for a while this weekend. I played Spirit Island. I think I've told you both about. Basically, it's
This is a very cool sounding premise.
It's been around for a while. It's been out of print for a long, long time. We finally have it back in the store. We're about to have some of the expansions in. So basically, this is a it's a game in which you play the spirits of this island. There is a conquering like force that is trying to take over your island. They've got cities and villages and little conquistador guys, and you, as different spirits, cooperate to try and push them off your island and destroy their cities and scare them so that they go away, and your local native people, who are represented by little mushroom pieces, live their own happy lives.
Yeah, finally a game of not... It's funny, because there are so many games about sort essentially colonizing.
Yep.
Like, just... And I know that most of the designers are not particularly thinking about that. It's just a mechanic. You know, you're building houses and roads and Settlers of Catan.
Yep.
But...
this is an anti-colonist
game. But it's an anti-colonist game. It's kind of one of those... I'm sure there's been others, but if there hasn't, it's about time.
So the names of the spirits, you all have different. You have a board, you have different powers.
These names are great.
You're placing your like little pieces from your board onto the board to give you places to radiate your power from.
Yep.
And as you do that, you get increases of power on your spirit, because they're all covered up on your board as you move them. So like, you get to draw more cards, you get to play more cards, you get more power to spend on your cards. Mm-hmm. The spirits that we played included River Surges in Sunlight, Lightning Swift Strike, Many Minds Move as One, Serpent Slumbering Beneath the Island, A Spread of Rampant Green, and Keeper of the Forbidden Wilds.
Yeah, those
they
are
all
dope
very
names.
Different powers and abilities and that kind of thing.
That sounds cool. What is the length of a game like this?
So when we played, I think it was like maybe an hour, hour and a half.
Okay.
I've heard it described as a longer game. It didn't feel overly long to me. I think partly I pick up games pretty quickly. And the two other people had played it, so we were able to run it down pretty quickly. I think your first new game probably would take a few hours.
Sure, that's pretty standard. But like, if once you know what you're doing, like maybe an hour and a half or something.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, it's great. We have it in stock right now. I'd highly recommend it. Also worth noting, I just, as we were recording, ordered more Root. So if you like Root, which I did just play as well, we're getting that and a bunch of new expansions.
Root has the, like the little fantasy woodland creatures.
It is a war, it's a war game, but you're little fantasy creatures. Yeah, you're like the bunny kingdom or the cat kingdom or the
the owl people. Yeah.
The owl people. Yeah. Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.